Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very gladly ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups that Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. That if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much like you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the further you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month for all your PayPal. Every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, well, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the
Oh, there I am, on mute, talking away a storm and not realizing that I'm on mute. Anyways, tonight, I want to, before we bring PJ on, and I hope that this serves as a springboard for PJ to really hammer in his position of strength in litigation, in any litigation. It is the cornerstone. And that is about federal citizenship in contradistinction to a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states. So what is the origin of the federal citizen? And all of the discussions that we've had so far, the little 10, 15, 20 minutes I take before PJ steps in, I really have not given you any proof that the government actually recognizes two distinct classes of citizens. And I'm going to give this evidence to you right now by exploring the 13th Amendment and the 14th Amendment. In 1865, the 13th Amendment abolished slavery and involuntary servitude except as punishment for a crime. The Supreme Court ruled that the 13th Amendment operated to free former slaves and to prohibit slavery, but it in no way conferred citizenship to the former slaves or to those of races, other than the white race. And that's because the founders of the Constitution were all white men. Now, Abraham Lincoln is considered, that he, quote, freed the slaves. I want to give you a quote from the fourth debate with Stephen Douglas at Charleston, Illinois, and this is 1858, okay? Not long before the Civil War, Lincoln said that he did not want to free the slaves unless they were deported. He said, and I quote, "I will say then that I am not, nor have ever been in favor of bringing about in any way the political and the social equality of white and black races, that I am not, nor ever have been in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people, And I will say, in addition to this, that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And as much as any other man am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race, I say, upon this occasion, I do not perceive that because the white man is to have the superior position, that the Negro should be denied everything, should not be denied everything. This was Abraham Lincoln, 16th President of the United States. So, the federal government did not have the authority to determine if former slaves could become a citizen of one of the several states because of the 9th and the 10th Amendments of the federal Constitution. It said specifically that powers not granted specifically to the federal government by the Constitution are reserved to the states or to the people. History shows that the Pennsylvania Commonwealth and the New York State were nationalizing these former slaves as state citizens, having natural rights. In other states, these former slaves were not citizens, and there were not going to be any effort by those states to make them citizens, and therefore they had no standing in court. So the answer to this problem was the very simple solution of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment used the term, quote, citizen of the United States, end quote. The courts have ruled that this means federal citizenship, which is similar to a citizen of the District of Columbia. Since the federal government didn't step in and tell Pennsylvania or New York that it couldn't make state citizens out of the former slaves, an argument could be made that the 14th Amendment was written primarily to afford voluntary citizenship to those of the black race, the African race, that were recently freed by the 13th Amendment. You have a number of cases often referred to as the slaughterhouse cases that support this, and specifically did not include Indians and others not born in and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Thus, this amendment recognized that, quote, an individual can be a citizen of one of the several states without being a citizen of the United States. Very, very clear. So to restate, in the slaughterhouse cases, Supra, it says, quote, it is quite clear then that there is a citizenship of the United States and a citizenship of a state, which are distinct from each other and which depend upon different characteristics or circumstances of the individual. Of the privileges and immunities of the citizens of the United States and of the privileges and immunities of citizens of the state and what they respectfully are, we will presently consider. But we wish to state here that it is only the former which are placed by this clause under the protection of the federal Constitution. And the latter, meaning state citizens, whatever they may be, are not intended to have any additional protection by this paragraph of the amendment. The court has ruled that the term United States is a metaphor. It's a figure of speech. In Cunard Shipping Lines, versus Mellon, I guess that was Carnegie Mellon back in those days. It says, quote, a sovereign occupying the position analogous to that of sovereigns in a family of nations. This is defining a United States citizen. It may designate a territory over which sovereignty of the United States extends. That's the second definition. That's for the federal territories. Or it may be a collective name of the states which are united by it under the Constitution, quoting Hooven and Allison. Now, did the courts really say that someone could be a citizen of a state without being a citizen of the United States? Did they? Yes, they did. And it's true that the case cited, they may be very, very old, some well in excess of 100 years. But none of these cases have been overturned by any recent decision. So they're valid. A more recent case, this is 1966. Okay, this is what, 34, 44, 54, less than 60 years ago. And it says, quote, both before and after the 14th Amendment to the federal Constitution, it has never been necessary for a person to be a citizen of the United States in order to be a citizen of his state. And, of course, what they were citing was the United States versus Cruikshank. The courts presume you to be a federal citizen without even telling you that there are different classes of citizen. And it's up for you to dispute this. In U.S. versus Slater, this is an IRS case, quote, unless the defendant can prove he's not a citizen of the United States, the IRS has a right to inquire and determine a tax liability, end quote. Well, this is very interesting. How could a presumption of class citizenship even be possible? It may be only, quote, guilty until proven innocent, end quote, if you're a federal citizen. In 1866, Congress passed the first Civil Rights Act, and this only applied to the District of Columbia and the federal territories, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. In 1868, the 14th Amendment was proclaimed to be passed. At this point, the number of subjects that the federal government had exclusive jurisdiction over increased to all of the former slaves that had not become state citizens. So you see, at that moment, there were former slaves who were citizens of one of the freely associated compact states that had natural rights. And there were other former slaves that only had privileges, and that's the ones that became citizens of the United States. There are many reasons that I do not take the 14th Amendment seriously. The first is that it's never been ratified. In State versus Phillips, and also in Dyett versus Turner, this court case was the Utah Supreme Court that wrote this. They said, quote, I cannot believe that any court in full possession of all its faculties would ever rule that the 14th Amendment was properly approved and adopted. Wow. State Supreme Court, Utah State Supreme Court. Further, in 1967, the Congress tried to repeal the 14th Amendment on the ground that it was invalid, void, and unconstitutional. The Congressional Record of the House, June 13, 1967, page 15,641, and the 9 pages of argument have been recorded about the infirmities of the 14th Amendment never having been ratified. The 14th Amendment reads in part, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. The validity of the public debt of the United States, blah, 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 shall not be questioned, end quote. There's a wealth of deception in what I just read to you because of the sheer number of words that have specific or multiple meanings in law depending on how they're used. When you go to the part that says, quote, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, end quote, the word the is used in its singular form, not the plural, as is the word jurisdiction. Had Congress meant the several states rather than just the District of Columbia, it would have been far more correct to say, end quote, subject to their jurisdictions, plural, end quote. In addition, a new pecking order is established with the phrase, quote, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside, end quote. If you research the terms resident and legal resident, you can find that it is the nexus that binds all of us to the state and to the federal enforcement of commercial law statutes today. Resident is the short form of resident alien, and it's used in the state statutes to mean someone who exhibits actual presence in an area belonging to one nation while retaining a domicile citizenship status to another foreign nation. Now, keep in mind, the United States, that is the District of Columbia, is foreign to the several states of the Union. The term legal residence further indicates that these two terms may be applied either to a geographical jurisdiction or a political jurisdiction. And an individual may reside in one but not the other, or in both at the same time. In the California code, its government code, section 126, it sets forth the essential elements of a compact between this state and the federal government allowing reciprocal taxation of certain entities and provide for concurrent jurisdiction within geographical boundaries. Both the state citizens, with the uppercase C, the sovereign, co-sovereignty, and the federal citizens, they're both Americans. United States citizens are domiciled in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, and they're privileged aliens to the state wherein they reside. And state citizens are domiciled in their respective states. They're not aliens in their states. And they also do not reside in their states. They are citizens of the state. The distinction may seem insignificant to you, but it's not to the courts. A state citizen has the right to travel in each of the 50 states, and he can file papers at any county courthouse in any state and actually become a citizen of that state. We'll talk about that on another time, but you're really going to want to hear about it. Most of the federal state statutes do not apply to citizens of a state. I repeat, most of the federal statutes do not apply to a citizen of a state. If the authority for that statute can be found in the organic constitution, then the statute is of national character as it applies to both state citizens and aliens. Quote, and this is United States versus Utterson. This is 1979, so this is just right around the corner, less than 40 years ago. Upon introducing the provisions, which eventually became 18 U.S.C. 242. How many times have you heard PJ talk about 18 U.S.C. 242? Deprivation of rights under color of law. Its sponsor was Senator Stewart, and it explicitly stated that the bill protected all persons. He noted that the bill simply extended to foreigners, not citizens, the protection of our laws, referring to the state laws. What could this mean? Well, it implies that citizens of a state already had the protections introduced by the statute, but it extended to foreigners this protection also. And what is a foreigner if they are not also an alien? Privileges granted by the sovereign governments and their capacity to license or to condone what might otherwise be illegal are always taxable and regulatable. Rights such as those envisioned by our founding fathers, they are not taxable and they are not regulatable because they are exercises of a common right that could be completely destroyed by government through taxation or regulation. These are maxims of law so well established they are irrefutable. You want to study it some more, just look at Frost and Frost Trucking versus Railroad Commission of California. It's a 1925 decision. Just look on your own. In 1868, we have a class of citizenship now created by the 14th Amendment, which is subject by grant of privilege from a sovereign power, federal Congress, exercising exclusive authority to govern its territories under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution. Federal citizens are created by the Congress. It is self-evident that all state citizens are created equal, and that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that governments are instituted to secure these rights. It's also self-evident that the sovereign Creator can never create an entity, government, and assign it more power than what the Creator possessed to begin with. Furthermore, the Constitution for the United States of America did not repeal the Articles of Confederation. It was only intended, quote, to make a more perfect union, end quote. Therefore, it logically follows that the Creator did not purposely intend to alter their status as the master to accept a role as servant to its own creation. And this is plainly shown throughout the Constitution, but specifically set forth in the 10th Amendment. The right to tax and regulate national citizenship is an inherent right under the rule of the law of nations, which is part of the law of the United States, as described in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. Quote, this jurisdiction extends to citizens of the United States, wherever resident, for the exercise of the privileges and immunities and protections of a federal citizen. Cook versus Tate. Virginia Law Review 607. The right of trial by jury in civil cases guaranteed by the 7th Amendment and the right to bear arms guaranteed by the 2nd Amendment have been distinctly held not to be privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States guaranteed by the 14th Amendment against abridgment by the states. And in effect, the same decision was made in respect of the guarantee against prosecution, except by indictment or grand jury. This is contained in the Fifth Amendment, and in respect of the right to be confronted with witnesses contained in the Sixth Amendment. The privileges and immunities, that is to say, the civil rights of the 14th Amendment citizens, were derived from, and the word derived means it was taken from, the federal Constitution. But they're not identical to those referred to in Article 4, Section 2 of the Constitution, which recognizes the existence of state citizens who are not citizens of the United States, because there was no such animal back in 1787. Plainly spoken, natural rights, considered to be grants from our Creator, our Heavenly Father, they're clearly different from civil rights that were granted by the Congress to its own brand of franchised citizens in the 14th Amendment. In Nickel versus Rosenfield, quote, a civil right is a right given and protected by law, man's law, and a person's enjoyment thereof is regulated entirely by law that creates it. In Wadley versus Newell, Title 42 of the United States Code contains the civil rights law that says rights under the 42nd, under 42 U.S.C., Section 1983, are for citizens of the United States and not a state citizen. In summary, if we're talking about here, and what we're talking about here, is a master-servant relationship. Prior to the 14th Amendment, there were state citizens and non-citizens. State citizens were the masters in the relationship to the government. After the 14th Amendment was declared to be passed, a new class of citizenship was created, which is both privileged and a servant subject to its creator, the federal government. I hope you've enjoyed this presentation and understood what I've just said. PJ, I'd love for you to step up, if you would, and bounce off of this and give us your thoughts on how you use these tools for the benefit of your students. Go ahead, buddy.
Well, I almost never use case law, and I always keep the burden of proof upon the federal government or the state or the city or the county or the municipality or the barking dog judge, whatever. Keep the burden of proof on them.
Perfect.
I truly believe that all that language about state citizenship is a trap, because I've seen it happen in courts where they I was in county court and they were trying to get jurisdiction, or they were trying to prosecute me, and this is after I've been in court hundreds of times, and I knew their games, and I was in front of a judge that was retiring, and I challenged personal jurisdiction, and the judge says, yeah, Mr. Prosecutor, we're gonna require you to prove up personal jurisdiction. And the prosecutor asked if I would be in the witness chair. And I said, yeah, I'll go in the witness chair. And he asked me, I think, about 15 questions. I should have went for a certified copy of the transcript. I just didn't do it. It would have probably been a really good YouTube time. But he asked me if I was a United States citizen. He asked me if I was a state citizen. He asked me if I had a Social Security card. He asked me if I was a registered voter. He asked me if I had a birth certificate. He asked me if I had a driver's license. It was amazing how many questions he asked me. It's almost like he had them written down, but he didn't. He had it memorized. And he knew exactly of the various nexuses that he's relied upon in the last 13 years that he was county prosecutor. And he asked me every question that I've ever thought of in my life, except for if I had a library card. I think that's the only question that I've ever came up with later on that he did not ask me. And to every question that he asked me, I said, not that I'm aware of. So he was relying on me to complete the sufficiency of the court as to the proof of personal jurisdiction. Personal jurisdiction is what did I, as a man, say, do, or sign to create a nexus with the written law that he's bringing forth. Now, he was bringing forth, in that particular case, was Nebraska. It was either state law or city municipal code law, which is the same jurisdiction. And it was certainly in a U.S. court. And those are the questions he asked me to try to complete the record with the sufficiency of evidence that the administrative U.S. court could move forward. And after he got done asking me all those questions, the judge just said that, Mr. Prosecutor, you haven't produced any evidence that this court has personum jurisdiction over PJ. And it was extremely interesting. I learned a lot that day. So the way I look at it is, I don't put hardly any value on case law, almost no value on it. Unless they could prove personal jurisdiction. Here's one way to look at it. Real simplistically, a judge gave this example once. He says, they come against you and they say that you have to have your dog licensed, vaccinated, quarantined or whatever, or chained up or on a leash or whatever. And they drug you into court and they're hammering you with all this stuff. And you stand forward and you say, is there any evidence I have a dog? The judge explained it to us. He said, sometimes it's that simple. Is there any evidence I have a dog? So the judge was trying to make the point that don't try to look at all the complexities of the written law that they're bringing against you, and just go right down to the foundation. Now, in our situation, we might have a dog, but do we have a dog inland where the written law that you're bringing has force and effect of law? So it's still a question of, do I have a dog in your jurisdiction? Same question. A little bit, just slightly more complicated, but not much more. So they have to produce the evidence that I have a dog in their jurisdiction, or I had a dog in their jurisdiction. It could reach to a any part of life: a fireplace, a seatbelt, a parking violation, anything. The judge explained to us that you need to get to the foundation and force them to produce the evidence, because a lot of the preliminary aspects of prosecution is they're trying to get you to agree with documents that have been filed by the prosecutor, where you had an opportunity to object to them or challenge them and you didn't. And then the court sets trial and basically railroads you into administrative proceedings and basically statism. Statism is, where you're not getting a trial by your peers. You're getting a trial by who they select as your peers or a individual judge. Most of the activity that most Americans do are not of the general jurisdiction of the federal or the state jurisdiction, or the city or the county or the municipalities. The one simple way to look at it is, let's say you have a municipality called the Municipality of Los Angeles, City of Los Angeles Municipal Code. What we do is we go into court and say, is the land that we own, that this activity is occurring on, does the City of Los Angeles have a ownership interest in it? And they'll say, no. Well, what is your legal interest then? another way to say it is nexus. They don't like to use the word nexus because they've just got ways to wiggle out of that word for some reason. I haven't really had somebody explain it to me, but you don't really want to go down the road with just the word nexus. But anyway, legal interest, evidence before the court that the personal jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction, it occurred in an area that where their written law has force and effect of law. Because their written law does not have force and effect of law everywhere in the world. And they'll admit that. So you look at the judge and you say, well, if that's true, then I can challenge territorial jurisdiction here. Now, a lot of the prosecutions will start arguing that, well, we don't know what the word territorial means. So you gotta, they just don't want it coming up, being brought up is the reason they say that. They're desperate. They're standing on their feet and they don't know what to say. So you just simply say that, we know we're dealing with a specific piece of land here. Does the written law that they're bringing have force and effect of law within that land? And the judge will look at you normally and say, you know, that's a very good question. And sometimes the police officer would get in the witness chair and say, yeah, that has to be because city snowplows plow that road for the last 20 years that I've been on the force. That still doesn't produce evidence of land jurisdiction. I can go plow that road for the last 20 years too, and it doesn't mean I own the land. So anyway, anytime somebody comes against you and they say you need shingles in your house, you need to pay a parking ticket, you need to pay property taxes, you need to pay state taxes, you need to pay federal taxes, you need to pay taxes on your purchase of your automobile, you need to register your vehicle, all that stuff you can challenge the jurisdiction. You need to tear down a building, you need to build a fence, you need to move your fence, all that stuff you can challenge with early stage jurisdictional challenge if it's done right. Now, if they ignore your jurisdictional challenge, we have processes where we can take it into federal court because the federal court will force them to produce that evidence. And the best way to do that is to kindly let them know that that's where it's going to go if they don't produce that evidence here and now. And give them time to do it. Don't put them on the spot. Give them time to go home and or go to their supervisor or whatever and ask those same questions. A lot of times the police officers, when I challenge jurisdiction in the past, they go to their supervisor and they ask for the evidence. And they come up to me later on and talk to me and said, you know what, they won't produce it. They won't give it to me. That's why I never testified against you. I asked the county prosecutor to give me that evidence, and he said, we don't have anything for you. And I said, well, I need that evidence that written law has force and effect of law there. I mean, I need to know myself if that written law has force and effect of law there because I'm being told every week to write tickets at that location. And in America, they have to produce that law because the United States Constitution is not a general jurisdiction document. It's a limited jurisdiction document. Right in it, it tells you where that written law operates. It operates in specific lands, and then it operates in another fashion on people and persons, corporations and associations and so forth that are created under the laws of that jurisdiction of that land. Either way, they got to produce that. So that's the angle that we take. Let's just say they come after you for federal taxes. Our program, which we've been working on for 30 plus years, because it's something they don't want to give up the ghost. They don't want to give it up. And but we've been able to assemble certain things and time-wise and so forth to force the courts to make a ruling on it. But they now normally they don't want to take it into a Supreme Court because they don't want the exposure. So they'll get put their feet to the fire and they'll get they'll want to bug out of the case early on. That's how you win your case. But we challenge them to produce the what they rely upon, that you as a man do not have a right to keep your proceeds of your labor from a specific activity that occurred in a specific land area during a specific time, and they need to give specific evidence of all those nexuses. So, Michael, can you still hear me, or have I been talking to myself for the last half hour?
No. I've been listening to you. I've just been polite and kept my mouth shut.
Okay. I always fear that I look down and my microphone's been unplugged for a half an hour or something.
Right.
But anyway, don't fret. You don't have to have all these case laws. And you don't really want to use them, in my experience. You want to keep the complete burden of proof on them. Let the jury know that that's all you've done. That's all you've done. We're running a case right now that we're telling the jury that for the last 10 years, that's all we've done is every year we've written them a letter and asked them to tell us how much, if we're required to file, and how much, if that's the case, how much are we required to pay. And they refuse to respond. They tried to ignore it. They try not to. Every time we bring it up in trial in the federal court, they just talked around it like, oh, that's nice that you did that, but it's not important. And they talk around it. And we were approached by several high-level legal people in the federal district that yes, they absolutely have to respond to that. That's a really big thing that they have to do. The law requires it, and if they don't do it, it's a felony. It's a crime. So that's the position we're taking, is to if a man, see, the government can't claim you have an obligation. The government cannot claim you have an amount of money due and owing. Only the agents and the officers of the government can make that claim. And they have to, and if you do it right, you can force them to make that claim under their own personal commercial liability. They can tell the truth and be protected by law, but they cannot tell a lie and be protected by law. You cannot say you owe $100,000 or $5,000 in federal taxes unless they have evidence that you are a person that's required to file and pay, and your activity occurred that is governable, and it occurred inland where that activity is taxable, and blah blah blah. They have to swear to all that stuff, and we're not jumping down their throat about it. We if they do have a claim, we'll give them some latitude of misunderstanding. So we're sympathetic to that, but we're not sympathetic to it when they even the Bible says, you know, if you point out an error to a man and he corrects it immediately, the damages are quite minimal in the court of law. But if he fights it all the way to the end, it can be up to seven times damages. The Bible gives different scenarios for different levels of damages. So we need to do the same thing for these IRS agents. Some of these guys are actually good people, and they just don't know. They just think they're doing their job. But once they get educated and realize that let's just say that you're a dentist, and you're not doing any activity on government land, and you're not under a government contract for that activity, and There's no government nexus there. How in the world do they have a right to take the percentage and require you to file and so forth and take a percentage of your chosen profession that you rely upon to feed yourself and your family as a right? They don't have any. I don't say they don't, but they may not have any. So put the burden of proof on them and make them bring that forward. Doesn't make what occupation. If you're a shoe salesman, a shoe manufacturer, a farmer, a banker, insurance person. For example, a lot of insurance people, they do have a nexus with the government, and they do have a requirement for taxes, I've been told. But even if I've been told that, that doesn't mean it's true. So let them tell you exactly how the nexus operates and being subject to the tax. Now, anybody that says that you're a citizen of the federal government or the United States or a citizen of the state, remember, always convert that word citizen to subject. Are you subject to the written laws that they're bringing forward, the United States written laws that they're bringing forward? Just a very simple, honest, straightforward question. Same way in this city, county, state. Do they have evidence that you're subject to those written laws? They're going to say that everybody is. Everybody knows that. And you have a right to force them to put everybody in the witness stand that they want to rely upon. And guess what? A lot of times they can't find a single person that'll testify to that. Now, if they do have the nexus of the liability, they'll easily put somebody in the witness stand. No problem at all. A person will get up there and testify that, yeah, he was mowing yards in the District of Columbia and he made $100,000 that year. And this is why the Constitution says that we can tax activity in that area of land. And the judge will go, yeah, that's true. Okay. That's it. You owe a tax. Now, if you were mowing yards 10 miles away on private property, the government had no nexus, they cannot, and they will not, put a person in the witness stand to testify to those same things. There are people that have minted coins, and they did the activity and they distributed the coins in the District of Columbia, and the federal court used that language to force them to pay taxes on the business of those coins. They clearly identified it as activity in the federal zone, even though that same person was minting those coins and distributing them all over America. They just happened to use District of Columbia to bring the federal suit. So I believe that person minting those coins, if he would have stayed out of the federal zones, they probably wouldn't even have gone after him. But he didn't know that. And if they did go after him, he only owed the tax on the federal zone activity. He didn't owe the tax on all the activity in all of America. So any questions out there, Michael, showing up on the screen?
Sure. Well, I've got to tell them how to do it first. We've got a lot of people here that are new.
Okay.
Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Star 2 to raise your hand. And I will unmute your line, and then you can speak directly with PJ. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, you will see a hey Nancy, you will see a rectangle of a silhouette laying on its side, empty. Left click inside that empty box. Type away your comment or question. Outside that empty rectangle, you'll see a place to put your contact information. Hit submit. It'll pop up on my end. And I'll be able to give voice to your comment or your question. So Nancy's first, followed by Norman, followed by Brian. Before we get to this, I want to clearly state to everyone hearing my voice, one, the comments that I made to introduce PJ was for one purpose, and that purpose was so that you could clearly understand that the federal government, through its ancillaries, the state, the county, the two residents, et cetera, that they clearly established that there are two different distinct creations out there, entities out there. These were not meant to be used in any way for you to use as defense or offense within a litigating strategy. It was only for the purpose so that you understood that there is something more than one class of citizenship out there and one class of laws that apply to these people. That's it, period. What PJ has to say with regards to, quote, maintaining the burden of proof on them, end quote, that is the key. But you can't understand what door that key unlocks unless you understand what all these other court decisions have talked about. So you've now, this week we talked about the origin of the federal citizen. When we do this call again next week with PJ, we're going to now then talk about how were the state citizens converted into federal citizens. And you're going to find that fascinating, trust me. And PJ has brought this up many, many times, so it's going to be right in his alley as well. But again, understand, when I talk about these court cases, they're not for you to assert in litigation. You can be, actually, your best defense is to be dumb as a rock and use PJ's quote. I have no evidence of such a thing. Duh. Okay? But you'll understand how that works because of these other court cases that we've talked about and you can read about. All right, so let's start with Nancy, and then we'll go to Norman, and then we'll go to Brian. Go ahead, Nancy.
I have two questions. The first one is short. So when you say no nexus with the federal government, does that include Social Security retirement payments?
Yeah. Yeah, if you study Social Security, it's only supposed to be extended to a very small group of people. I think Puerto Rico, but either way, Social Security is a standalone contract. It doesn't create U.S. citizenship. They will try to use that in courts to convince the administrator, the judge, that there is a nexus. But in federal court, it's been my experience. A few times clients coming back to me and talking to me about their case that when Social Security was brought up, the federal judge didn't want to do anything, didn't want to use it as any evidence to establish any type of jurisdiction. Now, in the county courts, I've seen them bring it up to try to make the appearance of jurisdiction. So, no, if they ever, the way you do it, when we go into court, we present documents, the document starts out, this document cannot be used to create any form of jurisdiction, I can't remember exactly how we got it written, but got it written pretty thoroughly. And then it also says what else do we put on there? Oh, no oral arguments. So we, right up front, when they bring charges against us in federal taxes or property taxes, whatever, we challenge them to produce that evidence. And they're required by law to produce that evidence because you don't have to go out and pick a lawyer out and have them defend you and blah, 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 until they actually produce evidence of the sufficiency of completing the court. Once they produce the evidence of sufficiency of completing the court, then you can maybe get serious about, hey, they really do have jurisdiction to pull me into that court, and I'd better hire a $100,000 lawyer or $50,000 lawyer to defend myself. So our country, fortunately, if you do it right, they have to produce that in a written format. That's why we go with no oral arguments, written format. And they send that to you, and then you've got several weeks usually challenge what they claim they're going to rely upon. Now, the last time we did this, they sent us 60-some cases, I think. 60 cases is a federal case for taxes. 60 or 70 cases when it was in this brief. We had to spend several thousand dollars just to get some legal minds to look at each case. And upon looking at each case, we found that not a single one of them was producing any evidence that our client had a legal duty to file or pay. So they just threw all kinds of cases in there and gave us 2 weeks to deal with it, and it was just all fluff. So we just sent a brief back just recently, and we're just saying that hey, it's, you know, you guys tried, but you haven't produced any evidence that our client had a legal requirement to file, a legal duty, any evidence that he's eligible or, like I said, required. And so that's still a void, and you haven't produced any evidence that he has money doing owing for any given year. And besides, we've been...
Well, my question was mostly about claiming a status as a state national. Didn't really have anything to do with taxes.
That's dangerous. I don't ever recommend that, claiming anything.
Not to claim your state national or identify yourself as...
Don't ever go into court and say that you're a U.S. citizen. Don't ever go into court and say that you're not.
Not about just going to court. It's about, you know, just, I don't know, getting a passport, a non-U.S. citizen passport and stuff like that, turning documents into, you know, like the federal government, the Secretary of State and all that.
Yeah, we do that. We get passports without a Social Security number. The reason you don't want a passport with a Social Security number is they can lock you down with a Social Security number. Because they'll say,
I'm talking about the DS-11 amendment, you know, on your passport, where you're getting, you know, the supposedly other passport, but it's all in the database that you're not a federal citizen. That's what I'm talking about, your status. Obviously you have to declare your status when you're filling out the DS-11, S-11 amendment.
Yeah, but anyway, they can put all they want down that you're a U.S. citizen stuff. You can even put it down. It doesn't make you a U.S. citizen. So if it ever comes that's not evidence. See, you can say that you're a U.S. citizen every day of your life. Just don't say it while you're under oath in a courtroom.
Don't say it. Okay.
You know.
Second question.
That's where it's very important to keep your mouth shut. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Before you get to your second question. Both the Supreme Court of the United States, not a state court, the Supreme Court of the United States, in two separate decisions, the first Bidwell, the last Hooven, 1901 and 1945, they both have defined United States with three definitions, whether it's United States land, United States citizens, the citizenship, whatever it is, there are three definitions. Just remember that. That's all. Back, go to now question number two.
All right. This is about a robbery in which I was the victim. This happened over a year ago. The county attorney is, handling the matter.
What's going on, Nancy? You're breaking up.
What's happening? I hear this beep. Is that on your phone or?
No, it's on yours or not on my end.
I hear it too, but it sounds like it's coming off your phone. But it's
okay,
all right.
Well,
I don't know. Maybe it's an incoming call.
Maybe they'll stop. Anyway, what's happening is that I wasn't notified of a hearing, or what happened is part of the evidence of the robbery, a cigarette butt was found on the floor of a storage unit, which is where the robbery was. And it took the police about, the crime lab, about 10 months. It finally came back, and it identified one of the people involved in the robbery. They identified five people being involved. But the county attorney decided not to, or just went ahead with the whole thing and didn't enter that as evidence to prosecute and, charge him properly, including that evidence. And when I found that out, that they had a hearing, didn't let me know so I could go and object, or that they weren't including it. And they just went, this happened a couple months ago. And then I finally found out by them sending me a letter describing what happened, because I was one of the parties. So I wrote them back. I objected to it. I sent a letter to all the parties involved, all the county attorneys, the judge, the, everyone. And they never answered. Then after a couple months went by, I realized there were five or six weeks, I wrote them again. Second notice, same thing. I gave them 10 days to answer, and I get no answer. So I just thought that they should include that as evidence and be charging this man accordingly, instead of only charging him for a misdemeanor of possession of stolen property. Now, I don't know if I have any chance to do anything as a victim or a victim's rights with these county attorneys and the way they're handling the case, because there's five people involved, and this is only one of them.
Well, they
so
have
what
a
is
constitutional
your comment
duty.
On that?
They have a constitutional duty to they're your employees. The people are the employers. They are the
right.
Employees. They're part-time help. They have a constitutional duty in their office to protect the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness of the people. So if you can let them know, we have briefs that we submit to them that we let them know that we believe that we can go into a court and put this issue before a jury and convince them that Joe Prosecutor did not protect my rights of life, liberty,
well,
and pursuit of happiness.
Well, isn't he, aren't they not living up to their oath that they all have to take as a...
Well, the oath is synonymous with the Constitution.
Life, liberty,
so,
and property, but... Okay, wouldn't the other thing be dereliction of duty and also prosecutorial misconduct? Or does prosecutorial misconduct, it seems, when I read over what that was, it seems like it's all built to protect the defendant. Does that apply to the victim?
Your leverage is they have a duty to protect your rights. That's your leverage.
All right. Well,
you can't go into those. Now, you can go for punitive damages. You can go for compensatory damages.
Ignoring it.
Yeah, you can sue the prosecutors. You can sue the judge. You can sue the county clerk if they all work together to deny you of these rights. The jury would decide that, the county clerk had a little bit to do with it. That's a $1,000 fine on them. The prosecutor had a big deal to do with it. That's $1 million. The judge had even a bigger part. That's $1.5 million. So the jury would decide that.
Mm. Yeah, I just feel like I'm just getting swept under the rug, and they just want to go ahead and get everything.
Sometimes they don't think they have a case. So you gotta understand that, sometimes they don't have a case. So.
Oh no, they have a case because these people were caught with some of the stuff, and they even admitted to so much stuff. So Yeah.
But anyway, you need to be suing those people civilly by yourself. Why are you letting the government do it? I mean, if the government's done with their prosecution, then you can go ahead and go in civilly because they can't say
that. Well, these people are all bums. They're all thieves and bums. I'm not going to get anything by suing them. There's five just, you know, drug addict bums that went around and started to rob storage units all down, you know, all across town. I'm not going to get anything by civilly suing them.
Well,
I just wanted some justice. I just wanted that man to be charged for, instead of a misdemeanor for possession, I wanted him to be charged for something more, you know, being at
felony,
the scene.
Yeah.
The felony.
Yeah.
And instead, they're just ignoring it. So that's why, and I'm at a point now where I don't really know what to do about it because I've already noticed them twice and they've ignored, didn't even bother to answer, you know, my demand for
justice
and victims' rights.
Welcome to statism. You know, it's bad. At times it's bad. They're not fulfilling the constitutional requirements.
Anyway, that's all I have to say, and thank you so much for your comments.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nancy.
Yeah. So biblically, you can take those thieves and chain them up and give them a bucket to go to the bathroom in, and they have to work until they get you paid off. You know, just chain them to a factory machine. They can eat out of that bucket. They can go to the bathroom in the bucket. And
all right.
As soon as they get done paying you off, they can go somewhere else.
Next is Norman, followed by Brian, followed by Ron, followed by Michael. So go ahead, Norman.
Yeah. Where do I start? You know, I've been listening for several months, and I kind of want to get some understanding of how PJ handles a case in a court, because I've heard before that he's not a bar lawyer, he can't really say anything, so it's up to me, the defendant, or whatever position I'm in, to say whatever I need to say, and that if I don't understand something, I say, well, put it in writing, and then we got several weeks to try to figure out what to say back in writing and that sort of thing. But when I'm in a state court or a federal court, I'm wondering, is it the same procedures, more or less?
Yes. Yeah, the same constitution applies in both courts.
So, I'm wondering then if it's correct that the PJ cannot represent me, or he can't say anything in regard to the case while I'm in front of a judge. Is that right?
No, you can have somebody come in, voice your position for you, help you with your position. Well, why would you want to do that? Your written format is so much better. So much better than any oral. You want to do everything, no oral arguments, because you get into oral arguments and
you can trap yourself, right?
Yeah, you're going to make mistakes, serious mistakes. So why would you want to put yourself in that position? Oral arguments is a very poor way of communication in such a technical issues, you know. Let them put
so
it in
the
writing.
So the witnesses that you want to stand, put them in the witness chair, who does the questioning? Myself? As the
You can have the questions written out beforehand. You give the witnesses the questions beforehand, and they bring in the answers.
The witness does not actually sit in the chair on the witness stand. Then he gets up there and says, "Okay, here are the questions. Give me the answers in writing," and he steps down and goes and does his thing, whatever it is. Is that right?
You can do it either way. You can depose people before trial and put that into evidence if they don't object. Or you can have them do it during trial.
I guess my conclusion is there any way where I could attend a hearing of which you're there actually operating in somewhere in Florida?
Our proceedings are almost all written, completely written. Very little.
You never
report.
Actually really appear before a judge?
Almost never.
Almost never, okay. All right. That does it for me tonight. Thank you very much.
Sure.
All righty, sir. Thank you so much. Next is Brian, and then followed by Brian is Ron, Michael, and that's it. Go ahead, Brian.
Good evening. Thank you guys as always. My question, PJ, you brought up minting coins and that triggered me in the cryptocurrency space. There's a lot of people bringing up their own tokens and, you know, what they would call tokenomics, you know, versus economics, and distributing coins. And there's something called the Howey test. I think that Bitcoin was qualified against, which created it as an asset, according to the powers that think they be. Would, you know, jurisdiction strategies be able to help those people who are getting maybe suppressed and pressed on by particular agencies and such when they're
if you're trying to produce a coin that's active with parity with the United States dollar, you're getting yourself in big trouble, and some people do that. They create they create gold,
not really
gold
that,
coins,
not really,
and
not really that context.
Yeah,
not really asset backed.
Yeah,
back.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it asset backed. I would call it.
But anyway, you have a right. You have a right to pull out a piece of paper and draw a picture and sell it for whatever you want. So if somebody doesn't want to pay you for it, that's the way it goes. That's cryptocurrency right there. If you got a Mona Lisa, they're going to pay you a lot for it. If you got a kindergarten's crayon thing, you're not going to get much for it.
Well,
but,
I mean, you're talking right now is more NFT based, which is non fungible token. These would be, I mean, they would still be non fungible token, but what the Howey test is you know, it's not a security. You're not getting a dividend for doing nothing. You're actually Bitcoin, you're proving work by the mining power that you're providing, and so therefore you're doing something.
Nobody's setting the value of that. It's just set by supply and demand. Anyway, that's all common law. It's all common law. As long as you're not there trying to defraud somebody with it, the courts don't have any jurisdiction.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I mean, it completely subverts all of the nonsense that surrounds it, that creates the fear, and yeah.
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 There are people that have had $10 million in cryptocurrency, and they didn't watch their computer close, and somebody got into their office and put in a key counter, and they stole $10 million from them. So cryptocurrency is very, they're very dangerous. They're very dangerous at times.
Unless you know what you're doing,
anyway.
There's many ways to protect. But yeah, no, thank you, and that very well answered my question.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
And it's true. Some countries are trying to. Russia's trying to ban cryptocurrencies. They can probably ban it in Russia, but our constitution forbids the government from banning it here. Go ahead. Next question.
Next is Ron from Cocoa. Go ahead, Ron.
Yes. Couple of comments. One, the young lady, first young lady with the problems having been robbed and the prosecutor not wanting to pursue. Can she or should she challenge their bond?
Well, their bond is if their bond is there to if they
but if they're not they're not performing, then can she challenge their bond and their oath of office?
It's not so much a challenge. if they're found to violate their office, they lose their, the bond company will, the bond is there to protect certain individuals for damages. It's kind of like an insurance policy. The a lot of those bonds are written in such a way that they're not all that great to help somebody. If the state is coming after you and the judge participates in trying to railroad you, they're in big trouble, you know, because they're violating the Constitution. They're committing a crime against you. You can always challenge that. Now, when somebody robs you and they step in to try to get some kind of a penalty against those people, jail or whatever, it's a different situation. They don't have to prosecute, but you drag it in front of a jury, and your common law principles of exercising your right, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and among those is protection of property. You throw it in front of a jury, and you ask for damages. If the jury goes, gosh, yeah, they should have protected this person's property. That's what they're there for. And they didn't do it at all. They're completely neglectful. That's going to produce chaos in society. The jury can go, well, what's their bond? You know, let's take the money from that bond and pay this person out of that for damages. And then after that's settled, see, then they're going to go back in and try to get that bond replenished. The bond company will say, no, we're not going to bond you. You're a bad performer. We're going to drop you. You got to go to somebody else to get a bond. And if they can't go to somebody else and get a bond, they're out of a job. That's how that works. A lot of times when an official officer loses his bond, he loses his office. They don't go around telling people that. But you'll all of a sudden, the next week, you'll find out they're resigned from their job. And nobody ever knows that they resigned from their job because they lost the support of the bond. And they're required to have a bond in that office. You can't find anybody to bond them. So, okay.
Yes, thank you on that subject. Next subject, the gentleman that was just speaking about crypto. According to sources on the internet, of course, George Soros supposedly owns Bitcoin. I don't know whether there's any validity to that or not, but that is a statement that has been made.
It doesn't make. He has every right to own it if he wants to.
Yeah.
He can buy it all out if he wants to.
Yeah. Simply a comment for information.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Anything else? We'll now go to Mike Murphy. Oh, Mike, go ahead, buddy.
Yes, thank you very much. Thanks for all the work you're doing. Are judges, lawyers, and prosecutors required to carry a bond?
I believe most of them are. Maybe all of them are.
So they're required to carry a bond.
I think every situation I've been in, they had some type of a bond. Now, a lot of times their oath of office is pretty wimpy the way it's written. I found that situation at times. I've found very few people being successful with attacking the oath of office. But the strength in the oath of office and the bond is going after them for violating your rights. That's where the strength is. When they disbehave in their office, the Constitution says they can only hold office during times of good behavior. Okay? If you have evidence that they're in bad behavior, at that moment, they lose their office. We've had federal judges explain to us that when they do that, at that moment, that very moment, might be six months ago, the trial's still going on. At that moment, that court lost, that judge lost administrative authority. He lost his oath of office. He was proceeding without office. So it's pretty interesting that federal judges would point that out to us. So what we do is we write a brief and we put in an affidavit of actually the event. A lot of times this happens when an individual has extremely good evidence. The situation I'm referring to, it was a good faith argument for taxes that he sent in our documents for several years asking them to assess him so that he wouldn't get in trouble. They never did respond to his reassessment request, and then years later they prosecute him. So we're going in and saying, and we brought that into trial, and the judge blocked it. The prosecutor blocked it, and the court clerk blocked it. So we're suing them all three, for doing that, and we're also going after putting in the evidence that that was misbehavior, that they can only hold those offices during good behavior, and that was not good behavior, so they lost their office at that moment. So we're putting in those arguments. Now we've been instructed to do that by federal judges, retired federal judges. It said that's why it's in the Constitution, for that very purpose, that behavior right there. That's why that's in the Constitution. They can't bring you into a trial and scare you to death and block your evidence that would, if it was presented in front of the jury, would probably result in a different result. They're not allowed to do that. That's mischief. So
when the IRS says it's frivolous, then it's that's the word they like to use. It's frivolous.
Yes, they use it all the time.
And we get into that situation
that, well, he's asking for an assessment and a sworn statement from us that he's required to file, and he has an amount due and owing, and oh, that's frivolous. And we just bring it back in, and we bring it out. Well, you might think it's frivolous, but Congress doesn't. And here's a statement from Congress right here, statutes at large. Oh, well, we didn't know that. Well, regardless, ignorance of the law is no excuse. That's the law, and you guys have a requirement to do that, and you've been told that for the last 3 years. So, not good. We're going for damages. You can't ruin your career and your marriage and your business and talk to your neighbors about you being an IRS crook from the people without. You better have some darn good evidence that it's true.
Well, that's the drum that they all thump. They thump that drum that you're not a good citizen. Well, and I don't play for
a good citizen,
but about paying taxes. I'll pay the taxes at the gas pump and every other tax, hidden tax they put into place. But as far as the federal income tax, I refuse to acknowledge it, to pay it. And they claim it's frivolous. But
don't use that language, because they'll use that against you in court. They could play this conversation in court, and you'd look very bad in front of a jury. You always say that they've never produced any evidence that I have a requirement to file, and they haven't produced any evidence that I have a requirement to pay any specific amount.
Right.
See, you and I are just dumb, stupid idiots. We don't know if we're required to file. We don't know if we're eligible to file. We don't know if we're qualified to file. We don't know if we do file that our very act of filing might be a violation of law. You can use that. It's illegal to file if you're not qualified. We use that against them. You going to make me file when I'm not, you won't produce any evidence that I'm required or eligible? Only certain people are eligible to file a 1040 tax form.
if you're in a trade or a business, a government employee.
No, it's generally in a nutshell, it's income derived domestically within the United States. Now that branches out to the employee and stuff, but it branches out to a lot of other things too. If you have a lemonade stand in the District of Columbia, you've got to pay taxes. If you have it across the street, private property, you don't have to pay taxes.
So if you're non-domestic, then you don't fall under their category.
If you're doing business on their land, it's domestic. If you're doing business outside of their land, it's without the United States, non-domestic.
That's yeah.
If you're doing business, if I'm selling lemonade on your land, your farm, you could tax me for that business. But if I'm across the street on my land, on my farm, what right do you have to tax me? Good luck finding that evidence. Real simple way to look at it.
I've used that, the domestic, non-domestic, because back in the day when I was a kid, I remember they used to have in the mail, in the post office, not the postal service, they had domestic and non-domestic. Well, I've taken all that out. But I've mailed letters to people for 2 cents, and I just write under it non-domestic, and it gets delivered to them.
Yep, that's because still works.
Postal code, the post office was in business before the government, and the government's incorporated now. So if they're incorporated, how do I become a corporate citizen?
No, it's not that. It's the statutes at large haven't changed. Mailing a first-class letter is still a specific way to gold, and that's what that's based on. And they don't want anybody to talk about that.
Well, of course not, because they're basically robbing everybody at the price of charge. But corruption breeds more corruption.
And, yeah.
If the GAO says they can't use certain evidence, like if they're depending on equipment they have to produce evidence, and they don't have physical evidence from a human being, then how do they get by with doing that?
Well, they usually squeeze it out of your mouth. People get in there and say, "Oh yeah, I'm a U.S. citizen," and I don't owe any taxes, and I don't have a requirement to file, and, you know, thank you. That's all we needed, U.S. citizenship. You're done right there.
Yeah.
And then if you say you're not a U.S. citizen, the prosecutor says prove it, and the judge will put in his documents. Well, he didn't produce any evidence that he wasn't a U.S. citizen, so he's done.
So it's better just to question it. Everything in writing and have them show you the evidence that they have or the law.
Absolutely. Yep. The worst thing, the people that lose the most cases are the people with a lot of knowledge in a U.S. court, because they have just enough knowledge to try to show their stuff and shifts the burden of proof to them, and they just turn to the jury and say, "Jury, you guys have to pay taxes. John has to pay taxes too, right?" The jury goes, "Right." They don't care about all your fancy this or that. But you can't let the jury make that decision. You've got to put the burden upon the moving party so that the judge has to dismiss the case as a matter of law.
Right.
If they can't produce any evidence, if they can't produce any evidence that you're required to file or pay, And they got all kinds of evidence that they've been given that opportunity, the judge has to dismiss the case. He can't put it in front of a jury. You put it in front of the jury, you're probably not gonna win. So you gotta lose it as a matter of law. I've done that many times. I've had them rule against me, and we put it on appeal, and we forced them to produce the evidence that we've asked for in the very beginning of the trial. It's not in the court record. They never, appeals court, look at the record. There's no place in the record anywhere where they produce evidence that I had a requirement to file. No place in the record. The appeals case writes back and says the court never gained jurisdiction to proceed to trial. Case dismissed.
Okay,
well, Michael, it's getting late.
Thank you very much.
I know it is. I know. We had a great call, and I don't want to
go. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Michael. I didn't mean to overtalk you. What?
Well, you guys keep up the good work, brother.
Thank you, sir, kindly very much. I want to thank everybody for joining us this evening. It was a fantastic call. Gosh, we went 35 minutes over, but that's okay. Join us next week. We will return. And, again, you're going to learn about how they suckered state citizens into becoming federal citizens. And it's all about what PJ talked about tonight with regards to Social Security and other things. So we'll go from there. Until then, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you.